whom really just object to the concept of doing these additional checks.
We should be clear, though, there are some people in this country who don't need the $2,000, who have done fine during the pandemic, who still have their jobs, who may even be saving more money than they were in the past. So let's look at the substantive argument there. Is there a case for what Mitch McConnell said in that recording that we heard just a moment ago, that you don't need to distribute money to everybody, you need to target where it goes?
You know, a lot of economists and analysts, not just conservatives by any means, say that passing a more robust unemployment package, something that would give people a little bit more money for a longer period of time or extend unemployment for a longer period, and other programs would be better ways to help people who are struggling the most, and that these blanket checks are not well tailored and not well targeted and don't have what is called the multiplying effect, which is getting more out of the federal dollar than, you know, than these other programs might.
Okay. In any case, that'll be left perhaps to a new Congress. We'll see. I want to ask in just the few seconds that we have about Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri. He says he's going to object to Congress when Congress certifies the Electoral College vote on January 6th. He's going to pass on President Trump's false claims about the election. How does that affect the process?
His objection slows down the process, but ultimately it doesn't change the result, which is that President-elect Joe Biden received 306 electoral votes. Votes and Trump received 232. You know, the rules that allow for a member of a House and Senate to object, and that's already, we've had an objection already in the House. And, you know, Hawley, there is no evidence of widespread election fraud, and Attorney General Barr has confirmed that fact, but Hawley says that he needs to speak up for the people who felt they were wronged.
January 6th is the only opportunity that I've got to speak up for my constituents in this process. This is it.
So there will be a delay of about 2 hours for additional debate, but there will still be a vote to certify the election.
Kelsey, thanks for your work all year.
Thanks for having me.
NPR's Kelsey Snell.
One of the most devastating effects of the coronavirus is how friends and relatives are kept away from the bedsides of the sick and the dying. Nurses and doctors shuttle messages between patients and their loved ones. The task is hard and often heartbreaking. Nick Mott of Montana Public Radio shares compelling and emotional accounts from one small-town hospital.
Livingston Healthcare is a 25-bed hospital that looks more like an upscale ski chalet than a medical facility.
So we'll just take your temperature?
Okay. It's framed by the rugged Absaroka Mountains, not far from Yellowstone National Park. But it could be anywhere. There are more than 1,000 hospitals about this size in the U.S. Today, 3 beds here are occupied by COVID patients.
Nice to meet you. Welcome.
Jen Schmid is the assistant director of nursing. She stands outside large windows that offer a view inside the hospital's 2 ICU rooms. The beds are empty, neatly made. But a few weeks ago, this hospital was in the midst of the biggest surge in cases they'd seen so far.
My job consisted of 24/7 begging people to try to come in to get help, coming in to try to staff it myself, just because we didn't have enough nurses.
The CDC recommends that hospitals limit visitation, especially during times of community spread. That requires balancing safety with the emotion and trauma faced by patients and their families. Here, the hospital banned most visitors. But when patients near the end of their lives, their closest relatives are allowed to say their goodbyes through those windows that look into the ICU. Schmid sat outside the room with families. She says that glass barrier between patients and their loved ones made farewells an even more emotionally devastating experience.
We see patients die all the time, but their families with them, and having to sit out here with the family and try to be their support and give them that affection or that caring when you yourself have to try to stay 6 feet away and they can't see their dad or their husband for the last time, and you have to watch that. It's gut-wrenching, and I don't think I'll ever get used to that. I've seen a lot of death, and I've held multiple people's hands while they're dying, but I've never had anything that has affected me like that. It's so foreign, and it's tragic.
Doctors and nurses experience that isolation very differently than do patients and families themselves, who maintain connection with each other only through screens and glass. Last month, Lori Schmidt's husband, Jerry, was in one of those ICU rooms.
If I had known, I mean, then I would never get to hold his hand or anything again. Oh my gosh, I would have done things so differently, but I guess naively, I really didn't think Jerry was going to die from this.
I met Schmidt at her home on the edge of Livingston.
Come on in, the blizzard.
She's 59, a retired banker, and calls herself a glass half full kind of person. Her husband was in his mid-70s.
He was an amazing man. He could build, fix, wire. He was an electrician. He could do anything. He could rebuild a Mustang from start to finish.
One night in early November, her husband fell down in their house. He had a fever and was throwing up. She called the paramedics, who took him to the hospital. It was the last time she saw him face to face. Schmidt says at Livingston Healthcare, nurses would call her from her husband's cell phone on FaceTime.
When Jerry pops up on my phone, there's a big daisy. And when I would see that, no matter how bad I felt renewed. It was like, Jerry's calling. I was so excited.
It was the closest she could get to human contact. When it became clear it was the end, the hospital brought the family into the ICU, where they could see Jerry through the window. She remembers the nurses at his side.
Listening, you know, saying, okay, they're telling you, you know, how much we love you and it's okay to go. And, you know, and my son-in-law and my son were, and mom, dad, don't worry, you know, we're going to take care of mom. And, you know, she's already got a honey-do list for us. And, you know, just trying to make him feel like he didn't have to hang on anymore because he was so tired.
Schmidt says Jerry passed peacefully after 12 days in the hospital. As we talk, it's been 1 month to the minute since his death. She's thankful for the healthcare workers who made sure her husband felt less isolated. Screens, windows, and all the small efforts of healthcare workers are a saving grace for Schmidt and people like her.
I mean, that made all the difference in the world.
Medical floor nurse Christy Blaine does the hard emotional work at the bedside patients need to feel connected.
It makes me sick to my stomach thinking about the fact that, like, so many people are dying alone, and their nurse that has maybe known them for a couple of days is the last person they see.
Nurses layer up in masks, protective glasses, and other gear to stave off the spread of the disease. Instead of smiles and facial expressions, only eyes can show emotion and establish connection.
You also, you know, feel bad for your patients because these Martians are coming in looking so different. You literally look like an alien and you're trying to care for your patients and they just feel like lepers.
She does what she can to make the hospital feel less sterile for her patients. Less like a, well, hospital. Blaine keeps a squishy, pink-haired unicorn dangling from a keychain on her ID badge. When you squeeze it, she shows me, a little brown bubble forms on its backside.
It poops. I like to joke around and I like to have fun and I feel like we only get one trip on this earth. And it might as well be part of a good old laugh. You know, nurses always ask about poop.
Sorry.
Blaine says that for nurses, adaptability is part of the job description. With only eyes peering out behind a mask, that pooping unicorn is one way of bringing joy into a world of isolation. Hospitals across the country are unlikely to reduce visitation limits much until the spring or summer, when vaccines are widely available. Until then, healthcare workers will continue to adapt, to innovate, and to find reasons to smile. For NPR News, I'm Nick Mott in Livingston, Montana.
This is NPR News.
19 past 8 now. You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Census Bureau is trying to fix irregularities uncovered in this year's records, and it will not be able to meet the deadline for the first set of 2020 results that are due by the end of the day. We'll have more on that from our census reporter, Hansi Lo Wong, in 15 minutes.
This week on Simply Folk, it's our annual sing-along show with your favorite songs by Kim and Reggie Harris, The Weavers, this tune from Mike and Peggy Seeger, and our first ever Simply Folk virtual house band, made up of listeners from around Wisconsin and beyond. You'll find the song lyrics at simplyfolk.org. Join the music and fun with me, Dan Robinson, this Sunday, 5 to 8 p.m. here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Cindy, get along.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/Wisconsin.
WGTD is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. A cultural asset and a community resource, WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College, with additional financial support from the Wisconsin Public Radio Association and local underwriters whose customers value public radio.
In the weather for today, sunny in the south, decreasing clouds for the rest of the state, and highs in the mid-20s. For Friday, New Year's Day, sunny in the northeast, partly sunny in central and northern Wisconsin, cloudy with a good chance of afternoon snow showers in the south, highs ranging from the mid-20s to around 30.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Frederica and Howard Stevenson, supporting Olin College, which is working to help the next generation of engineers develop the entrepreneurial skills, experience, and mindset to bring technological innovations to market. Learn more at olin.edu. From Rocket Mortgage, working to help home buyers find a home loan that fits their budget. Home buyers can adjust payments, see tax estimates and closing costs, all in real time. Rocket Mortgage, Rocket Can. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, committed to supporting ideas and institutions to advance education for all, preserve the environment, and promote vibrant performing arts. More information is available at hewlett.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Navigating grief is hard when there's not a global pandemic, and Nora McInerney knows that well. In 2014, she had a miscarriage, and she lost her father and her husband to cancer, and this all happened within several weeks. Since then, she's built a life and a career talking about and finding humor in the midst of grief. She's got a podcast called Terrible, Thanks for Asking. She's also written a lot of books, and she started her own support system.
I have a grief group called the Hot Young Widows Club. It's just a name. It's I made it up when I was 31. It felt funny. I don't know if it is anymore, but you know, don't worry. My mom's in it, and she's in her 70s.
She's probably hot.
My mom is a babe. She is single. We do want a new dad. But I've watched many, many widows join the Hot Young Widows Club, and grief is always so lonely.
All week, we've been hearing from people mourning personal losses that weren't directly connected to the pandemic, but it did shape the way they tried to move on.
I think miscarriage is kind of a solitary loss to begin with.
There's a reason why we have that gathering of people to mourn together so that you can move along on the next step. And we haven't done that.
It's sort of like you're the last speaker of this language, you know, that no one knows anymore.
That was Erica Pullman of Solon, Iowa, Scott Williams of Lebanon, Indiana, and Joel McElmore of Portland, Oregon. I asked Nora about that experience, grieving a loss that feels separate from the pain and drama of the pandemic.
The pandemic is millions and millions of stories like those. It is my second grader laying in bed at night, weeping that he doesn't get to go to school, doesn't get to make a friend, that he's lonely. It's all of these things that feel so personal, but those are the things that connect us even outside of a global pandemic. And grief always feels like it's happening just to you.
So many conversations I had over the course of the past year with friends or family, you would say, how's it going? And, you know, they would lay out the suffering, real suffering that they had been facing. And then always, it always finished with, but of course we're fine. Like, we have much to be grateful for. We're fine. And it was just this almost a diminishment of the thing they were going through, because it's always comparative.
Yeah. Everybody, I mean, it does feel like there should be some sort of ranking system, doesn't there?
like I'm only a four. It's okay.
I'm only a four. And one time I did go to the ER. I'd fallen off my bike and the nurse said, how does it feel on a scale of 1 to 10? And I said an 8. And she said, that's a gunshot wound. And I'd never been injured before. So I was like, why tell me a scale? This is an 8 to me.
Right. And it's my 8.
It is all, it's this scale that just does not translate. It just doesn't. Right. Even if you're all grieving the same thing too. My husband died. I was, as far as I know, his only wife. He was his mother's only son. He was his sister's only brother. We lost very different relationships, even though it was technically, you know, legally speaking, the same person. One death certificate, 3 very different brands of grief.
And of course, so many people have been robbed of the ritual around grieving, right?
Oh, yes.
Talk a little bit about what that does to a person to not have, I hate the word closure, but to not have that mark in time, that moment when people come together to celebrate a life.
Oh, I didn't even know to be grateful for the fact that I got to do that until I watched other people lose that privilege. I mean, the people who have experienced a primary loss like that, like a mother, a father, a partner, the loneliness of grief is compounded by their inability to, I mean, have somebody sit on the couch and hold your hand. And what I have been telling everybody who is suffering right now is that if you are struggling, you need to tell the people who love you, the people who want to show up, how to do that for you.
Yeah. Do you think we as a culture, as a society, after enduring so much loss collectively over the last year, do we come out wiser and better and more empathetic, perhaps?
Some of us, but America is addicted to positivity and to our own sense that everything is fine. We're doing a good job. To the harm and detriment of so many people.
There's a tendency in conversations like these to always find some kind of grace note to end on, right?
Like, I'm so sorry. No, you should not have interviewed me.
This is, but the whole point is that we can't rely on other people to articulate that for us. It's okay to sit in the sad.
Yeah. And honestly, like, we're just at the beginning of it. And what this whole, like, coming up with a vaccine and this, which is an amazing accomplishment. Thank you so much for doing that. Science, like, that to me feels like the funeral. The funeral is a marker, but your grief isn't done at the funeral.
Nora McInerney, it has been such a pleasure talking to you.
A dream come true. I also promised myself I wouldn't say that. What a freaking nerd. I'm so sorry.
It was great. Nora, you should check out her podcast. It's called Terrible Thanks for Asking. Happy New Year, Nora.
Oh, thank you. And you know what? 2021 might not be any better. And you know what? Honestly, it has taught me the joy of being okay. A good day is not a 10. A good day is a 5. A 10 is exceptional. Like, just be happy with a 5. Like, what a great day. Nothing terrible happened. Wonderful. Sounds great. Also, I'm giving you the Minnesota goodbye, which is like, that's my country of origins. Like, someone says goodbye to you and you're like, one more thing. And now I will follow you to your car.
This is NPR News.
Burnout can come for anyone, even religious leaders.
I'm tired, and I need you to know, secondly, I feel very distant from God.
I'm Elsa Chang. We meet a pastor who stepped away from the pulpit after 30 years, then returned to lead his congregation through the pandemic. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and all the day's news on All Things Considered, it starts at 4 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and a news update is next. One of today's stories looks at Wisconsin's increasing population of invasive gypsy moths, which damage trees and shrubs. That story and more Wisconsin news after the latest from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Senate appears unlikely to pass higher direct coronavirus relief payments as standalone legislation. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants them included in a broader GOP package. The House voted to raise the payments from $600 to $2,000 after President Trump complained that relief was insufficient. Today's the deadline for the U.S. Census Bureau to report the first set of results from the 2020 national headcount. Officials say they won't meet that deadline. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang says that could jeopardize President Trump's push to alter the count before he leaves office.
Federal law says Thursday is the last day for the Commerce Secretary, who oversees the Census Bureau, to report new state population numbers to the president. The numbers are used to determine representation in Congress and the Electoral College for the next 10 years. But COVID-19 and schedule changes by the Trump administration are forcing the Bureau to miss that deadline. There's no penalty, but this delay could mean that President Trump may not get control of the numbers that he wants to try to exclude unauthorized immigrants from, despite the Constitution's requirement to include the, quote, whole number of persons in each state. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, New York.
New claims for jobless benefits in the U.S. dropped by 19,000 last week. Still, the Labor Department says first-time claims are nearly four times higher than 1 year ago. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Wisconsin is seeing a rapid conversion to solar energy as a growing number of utilities set goals this year to go carbon neutral by 2050. Danielle Kading reports the investment comes despite challenges brought by the COVID-19 pandemic.
There are 20 solar farms that are under active development in the state that will generate more than 2.2 gigawatts of power. That's according to Michael Vickerman, policy director for Renew Wisconsin. Vickerman says that's about 7% of the state's annual electricity use.
So there will have to be another wave, several waves, in fact, of solar coming down the pike after the first 20 projects have been built.
Vickerman says the power generation shift has been driven by the declining cost of solar as coal becomes more costly to operate. The state's five major investor-owned utilities all have solar projects that have either been proposed or are in the process of being built. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The invasive gypsy moth has managed to increase its numbers in Wisconsin this year. That's according to the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Its annual trapping program caught more than 83,000 moths this year, compared to about 52,000 the year before. The moths can damage or kill tree and shrub species by eating their leaves. Michael Falk, gypsy moth trapping coordinator for Wisconsin DATCAP, says last year's more typical winter didn't have the long stretches of extreme cold that had killed off many egg masses the previous two winters.
Rebounding from a historic low, we're about at an intermediate population when you take the last 5 years and what the numbers have looked like.
The gypsy moth is now established in the eastern two-thirds of the state and has been spreading westward over the past two decades. Wisconsin has seen its seven-day average of new coronavirus cases tick slightly up, though the average remains lower than the peak in November. The Department of Health Services confirmed 2,755 more cases of coronavirus infection yesterday. That pushes the seven-day average to 1,956, down from the average of roughly 6,500 in the middle of last month. DHS also confirmed 126 more people hospitalized because of the virus and 35 more deaths. In all, 4,818 people have died from COVID-19 in Wisconsin. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio.
AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at c3.ai.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
And I'm Leila Faldin in Culver City, California. Today was supposed to be the start of turning this year's census results into political power. But the Census Bureau announced the results will not be ready until early 2021. That delay will have big implications on how many electoral college votes and seats in Congress each state gets for the next decade. NPR's Hanzila Wong covers all things census-related. He joins us from New York to explain what this means. Good morning, Hanzi.
Hi, Leila.
So this delay was confirmed to you by a source last night. Can you break down why this is so significant?
Well, what was supposed to happen today was new state population counts from the census were supposed to be reported to the president by the Commerce Secretary, who oversees the Census Bureau. These are the numbers used to determine each state's share of seats in the House of Representatives, as well as electoral college votes for the next 10 years. Federal law says today's the last day to report those numbers, but this year, the Census Bureau is missing this reporting deadline for the first time since it was put in place more than 40 years ago. There's no penalty for missing this legal deadline, but that does further complicate an already messy census process.
So what's behind the delay?
COVID-19, number one, as well as the Trump administration's last-minute schedule changes to the census that cut short counting, as well as the time for running quality checks. You know, the main problem right now is the Census Bureau has found irregularities in the records, and it needs more time to make sure no one is counted twice or in the wrong place. You know, inside the Census Bureau, missing this deadline is a very big deal because the civil servants there are very aware that major delays in delivering these numbers could throw off all the other steps to come afterwards to get House seats reallocated and eventually voting districts redrawn.
So you've also been reporting on how President Trump wants to alter these numbers before leaving office. How does this delay affect what the president's trying to do?
Well, President Trump wants to exclude unauthorized immigrants from those state population counts, despite the Constitution's requirement to include, quote, the whole number of persons in each state. And so a delay in getting out these results, these population counts, could mean that President-elect Joe Biden ends up receiving the numbers Trump wants to alter. Yeah. So a big question right now is how long it will take for the Census Bureau to finish fixing these irregularities they found in the records. There's also a worry that the Trump administration may cut short the quality checks and force out inaccurate and incomplete numbers. If they do that, the clerk of the House of Representatives, who certifies each state's new number of House seats, may refuse to accept altered numbers, and that could spark just a flurry of more lawsuits.
Hanzi, it sounds like you have a lot to keep track of before Inauguration Day. What are you looking for next? What are you watching?
I'm watching to see what happens around January 9th. A source within the Census Bureau tells me that's when the Bureau internally is trying to see when they'll may start the last steps in processing these census records. And that may be when we find out when the first set of results eventually come out.
NPR's Hanzila Wong, thank you for all your reporting on the census.
You're welcome, Leila.
For the past few years, a man named John Demers has had a big job. He's been leading the Justice Department's National Security Division. He took the job in the aftermath of Russia's interference in the 2016 election. As he prepares to leave office with the Trump administration, the U.S. is dealing with another massive hack.
Well, there is a certain symmetry to all of this.
Demers spoke with NPR's Ryan Lucas about his time in office.
As the head of the Justice Department's National Security Division, John Demers has overseen cases against Iranian hackers, Islamic State terrorists, and American turncoats. But he spent much of his time focused on two foreign adversaries, Russia and China. That point was hammered home by Russia's recent hack of U.S. government agencies.
In terms of this hack, it's quite significant, although, you know, we're still working to understand the scope of it, the breadth of it, and the depth of it.
But Demers says from what he's seen so far, it appears to be different from Russia's cyber attack on the 2016 U.S. election, when the Kremlin wanted to sow chaos and undermine democracy.
This looks like more what a nation state would traditionally try to do through human means, through spies, but trying to do it through technical means and cyber intrusions.
While the Russian hacks are bookends to the Trump administration, U.S. officials say China is America's number one long-term rival. They've accused China of waging a relentless campaign to steal U.S. intellectual property, government secrets, and academic information to try to replace the U.S. as the world's preeminent economic and military power. From his perch at the Justice Department, Demers says China stands alone in its plundering of American corporate secrets.
We do see some other countries engaging episodically in economic espionage, but none of them on the scale and sophistication and persistence of the Chinese government.
Demers says 80% of the Justice Department's industrial espionage cases involve the Chinese government, while two-thirds of its trade theft cases involve a Chinese company. In the past few years alone, the DOJ has unsealed dozens of indictments related to China. It's charged American and Chinese researchers and business people for stealing everything from high-tech wireless design to turbine technology. It's brought cases against U.S. academics for failing to disclose ties to the Chinese government. And on the political espionage front, three former U.S. intelligence officers have been convicted of spying for Beijing, while a fourth is facing charges. The department's crackdown hasn't brought an end to China's operations, and it won't, but that doesn't mean it's not having an effect, Demers says.
These prosecutions are not silver bullets that are going to make the problem go away. The Chinese are very persistent, the will is there, and the resourcing is there. But we're going to call attention to them, we're going to shine a light on it, and we're going to make their job harder and harder.
One thing the department's indictments do is disrupt China's activities. Demers points to a case of a Chinese intelligence officer who was extradited to the U.S. from Belgium in 2018 for allegedly trying to steal jet plane technology.
The significance of that wasn't just the disruption of that avenue of economic espionage. The other significance was making the Chinese think twice and more than twice about using Europe as a safe place to meet Americans who they were trying to co-opt.
In other words, it sent a signal to China's spies that they no longer had a free hand in Europe for such operations. Demers says he's seen an impact on China's activities in Europe since then, but he declined to provide details. As Demers' time leading the National Security Division comes to a close with the change in administration, he sees plenty of work ahead for the Biden team. One growing challenge that he'd focus on, Demers says, is countering China's covert efforts to influence U.S. policymakers. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:42 right now. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, every year at this time, we pay tribute to some of the musicians we lost during the year with some moments of their work. It's been a big one for those losses. Ahead, a musical montage, including songs from Helen Reddy, jazz saxophonist Jimmy Heath, and Little Richard, among many others. That musical memorial in 9 minutes.
While the COVID-19 pandemic can feel overwhelming, the good news is that just a few simple steps can help stop the spread and save lives. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services recommends wearing a mask, washing your hands frequently, maintaining social distance, and limiting gatherings. Learn more about COVID safety, including information about testing locations and COVID activity levels in your area at dhs.wisconsin.gov.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
Support comes from the Choral Arts Society, premiering a YouTube video review of past Christmas concerts December 29th at 7 p.m., followed by a video conference afterglow. In conjunction, the Sebastians is offering a special curbside pickup dinner. Visit choralartsonline.org.
And the From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Lemon Street Gallery is hosting the Artistry Holiday Gift Show. November 12th through December 24th, dozens of local artists, members, and area artists showcase their artwork for your gift-giving needs. Visit lemonstreetgallery.org for more info.
Ranging from the mid-20s to around 30. Saturday and Sunday, mostly sunny skies, highs around 30 across the state.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From Indeed, committed to helping businesses hire. When managers upgrade their job posts, they instantly get a list of candidates whose resumes on Indeed match their job criteria. More at Indeed.com/credit. And from Americans for the Arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Being an elite athlete takes discipline, talent, and hard work. But according to a new book, there are also a bunch of invisible factors that help create champions. Planet Money's Greg Krasalski has the story.
When COVID shutdowns suspended live sports this year, The Last Dance threw us all a life preserver. The ESPN documentary miniseries let us all relive the magic of Michael Jordan. And it gave us insights into some of the factors that led him to become one of the greatest athletes of all time. Here he is talking to ESPN.
That competitiveness within me started when I was a kid.
One of the factors that Michael Jordan credited with driving him to win on the court was playing with his older brother, Larry.
I don't think from a competitive standpoint, I would be here without the confrontations with my brother. I always felt like I was fighting Larry for my father's attention.
According to a new book, The Best, How Elite Athletes Are Made, having older brothers or sisters isn't just a great plot point in a life story. It shows up in a lot of research about who is more likely to become a champion. The book was co-written by sports scientist Mark Williams and sports writer Tim Wigmore.
Even when two siblings both become elite athletes, the younger one is better in about 2 out of 3 cases.
Wigmore says another good example for the younger sibling effect is Serena Williams. She has an older sister, Venus, who is also a great tennis player. But Venus didn't win as many Grand Slam titles as Serena. As kids, younger siblings are exposed to sports through their older siblings, and they're usually smaller and weaker than them, which means they have to work harder to keep up. Wigmore says this helps them gain skills and grit.
And so with Serena Williams, actually, you look at pictures of her playing with Venus as a kid, and there's like often 2 or 3 inches between them, and that means she has to try and make up for that whole time.
Another factor helping younger siblings, he says, is parents are usually more hands-off with them. Younger siblings are often given more time to mess around and play sports with their friends or older siblings. This informal play helps them not only play more, but also develop their athletic skills through trial and error as opposed to top-down, rigorous instruction.
Kids who do more informal play, it's better for their creativity. They're also just exposed to more variables, more different situations. They have more chance to learn, more chances to fail, and that's really good for you.
Another ingredient that helps create elite athletes. Growing up in a mid-sized town, a place small enough to have lots of space and opportunity to play sports, but big enough to have good coaches, facilities, and competitors.
Where you grow up is one of the biggest factors that influences whether you become an elite athlete. So in the US, amazingly, if you grow up in a town of between 50 and 100,000, you have 15 times more chance of becoming an elite athlete than if you grew up in an area smaller or bigger.
Michael Jordan, for example, grew up in the mid-sized town of Wilmington, North Carolina, which was under 100,000 people when he grew up there. During the 20th century, Wilmington produced a whole host of elite athletes, including Sugar Ray Leonard, an Olympic gold medalist in boxing. Sugar Ray, by the way, also had an older brother, Roger, who started boxing first. As for Wigmore, he was not raised in a mid-sized town. He's an only child, and he hasn't really benefited from any of the other factors he writes about in his book.
And that helps to explain why I write on sport rather than play it.
We can all slam dunk like Michael Jordan. Greg Rosalski, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday, committed to delivering quick insights to help finance teams plan for what's next. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. Learn more at workday.com.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after the news from NPR and WPR, we'll have classical music. Ruth Ann Bessman sitting in for Stephanie Elkins. Stay with us.
The news is moving fast right now, and across a number of really big stories, the stakes are high. The truth is, we do not know what lies ahead. I'm Noel King, co-host of Morning Edition from NPR News. And what I do know is that every morning we will be right here, live, bringing you verifiable facts and information as soon as we have them. Listen every day.
Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on WPR. In sports, the Badgers football team beat Wake Forest 42-28 in the Duke's Mayo Bowl yesterday. The Wisconsin men's basketball team is scheduled to play Minnesota this afternoon at 3:30. The women will play Michigan at 11:30 this morning. And the Milwaukee Bucks lost to the Miami Heat yesterday 119-108. Here's what the weather forecast looks like today. Sunny in the south, decreasing clouds for the rest of the state, highs in the mid-20s. On Friday, New Year's Day, sunny in the northeast, partly sunny in central and northern Wisconsin, cloudy with a good chance of afternoon snow showers in the south, and highs ranging from the mid-20s to around 30.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Falden.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Every year at this time, we pay tribute to some of the musicians we lost with a montage of moments from their work. To name just a few, we're about to hear Joseph Shabalala, founder of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, the singer Helen Reddy, jazz saxophonist Jimmy Heath, the soul singer Betty Wright, and one of the architects of rock and roll, Little Richard.
You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em.
The devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone.
Too big to ignore.
Do a man go jangles and he dance for you.
tell you twice. I'm real discreet, like a thief in the night.
This door don't open till after dark, and it ain't till 12 till the party really starts. And I always had to be home by 10, right before the fun was about to begin.
Step into the realm, you're bound to get caught, and from this worldly life you'll soon depart.
Down the walk across this world is deceptive. Beats are perfected, the ghetto's infested.
This year, the coronavirus took the lives of many great musicians, among them the country star Charlie Pride, New Orleans patriarch Ellis Marsalis, songwriter John Prine, and saxophonist Lee Konitz. We honor them now.
Kiss an angel good morning and let her know you think about her when you're gone.
Our musical tribute to some of the artists we lost in 2020. Produced by Tom Cole, with help from Morning Edition's Phil Harrell and NPR researcher Jane Gilbert.
So if you're walking down the street sometime, spot some hollow ancient ash.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
As if you didn't care, say hello in there.
You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. On this final day of 2020, special and heartfelt thanks to the WPR engineering and IT teams. We would not have gotten through this year without their unceasing work. It's a minute before 9.
You rely on Wisconsin Public Radio for independent journalism, compelling stories, and refreshing entertainment. Member support is the largest source of funding for the WPR programs you value and enjoy every day. Thank you, members. You make it all possible.
Support comes from Gateway. The new semester begins January 19th. Although Student Services is closed through the holidays, browse the program catalog and register online now. Starting January 4th, career counselors will be available via phone, email, online chat, or Zoom. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elk.